Hello, everybody. Welcome to the 120th episode of the Manor Podcast. I'm your co-host, Roger Bodie, joined as always with my best friend and other co-host, Michael Hamilton. Michael, if a tree falls in a forest and nobody hears it, does it still make a sound?
Yeah, that's how physics work.
How do you know?
I don't.
What if it's a really tiny tree? It could be a baby tree. I never specified the tree size, you know?
Sure. Small trees falling still make sounds.
Not necessarily. You don't think a tree could fall quietly?
I mean, quietly is just like comparative to how loud trees usually are when they fall. I don't think a tree could fall and make zero sound.
Why?
Because that's just how things work. When a tree falls, it makes sound. It goes crack, like that. So that's what a tree falling sounds like.
So you don't subscribe to the philosophical belief that a perception is what makes things real?
I do not.
You think there are fundamental aspects of reality that are true regardless of whether or not we can perceive them?
Yeah, and I was actually talking to Casey about this, like, not that long ago, or something similar, where we were talking about aliens, and I'm like, you know, if there are aliens, it wouldn't surprise me if they just have, like, some sense that we don't have, we don't even know exists. They're just, like, sensing things in a completely different way.
You know what Fermi's paradox is?
Nope.
It's basically the paradox that if the universe is so big and vast, like statistically, we shouldn't be the only like sentient beings out there, but yet we can't find any other sentient beings. So it's like the paradox of like the math versus like what we've experienced so far.
Yeah, that's fair. I hadn't heard of the paradox, but I did know that mathematically, it seems very likely there would be other things because there's so many planets, so many galaxies.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe we're the special, unique sunflower snowflakes of existence, though. You know, maybe there's no other. Maybe this is it.
There's a lot of snowflakes in the world.
I mean, like in like theoretical all of existence, maybe there's only one, where maybe we're the only sentient life forms out there. It's not impossible.
Yeah. I think it is less likely than that there are other life forms somewhere out there, but not 0%.
Yeah. What I'm saying, it could be 0%.
Sure. It's either 100% or 0%, right?
Yeah, I guess it's a binary thing, right?
Yeah, it's either true or it's not, but...
Yeah. But you know what's definitely true is that this is a great podcast and it's time for us to talk about Flesh and Blood again.
Okay. I'm glad those things are true.
So the main thesis of this argument, or what we're going to talk about today, is going to be like timing and like the core game mechanics of Flesh and Blood. And it's been a while since we've done like a fundamentals episode or like just a episode that talks about things outside of like current metagames, current set designs and things like that. So I'm excited to have this conversation.
Yeah, me too. I think it's relevant with our recent ban announcement too.
Yeah. So as we perfectly predicted last week, Got Your Blessings wasn't fully banned, but the blue one was banned, which basically makes the deck a lot less interesting. And I think some people are arguing that the deck is still viable, but you know, there's a lot of viable deck options out there. But if you were trying to pick the best deck to win a tournament, I don't think it's Count Your Blessings anymore.
Yeah, I think I'm not even convinced it was Count Your Blessings before, but here we are.
Yeah. I mean, in one world, it has to be good, you know?
Yep.
Name one deck that won worlds that wasn't like immediately a tier one deck following the event.
We've had three worlds, right? Mm-hmm. First one, Volander. That one was pretty good. Second one, some ninja named Fi.
Yeah, been terrorizing Classic Constructed over the past year.
Yeah, I definitely remember Phi winning anything after that Worlds.
Uh-huh. And then now Count Your Blessings Enigma. So.
Yeah, and that one doesn't get a chance because Count Your Blessings Blue got banned. So.
Mm-hmm. And then High Octane getting banned because, you know, we all knew that's what was going to happen.
Yeah, LSS has been dropping hints that thing's on its way, that thing has been on its way out for a while. So. Mm-hmm.
Getting a lot of action points turns out is good. I thought the whole interesting thing that dropped out of that article was that they want mechanologists as like a class identity to be able to attack with a weapon multiple times per turn. Mm-hmm. Did you read that?
Yeah, I didn't see that.
That's pretty interesting, right?
Yeah, but I think Banksy still wants per turn, right?
We're not talking about Banksy. No, okay. Nobody cares about that one.
Maybe Max will get a real weapon someday.
Yeah, I still consider it to be like top or bottom five weapons in the game. That Banksy might even be like bottom two, bottom three. I don't know. It's one of the worst.
Has an on hit.
Even Talishar, at least, you know, if you're determined and you really want to like activate Talishar, you can do that. Banksy has just like such a high like ask on like a given turn cycle that it's like activating it just seems like the juice just isn't worth the squeeze, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. It's just you don't want to be cranking things in max. Like
we want to keep your hyperdrivers around, so cranking them is counterintuitive to like your overall game plan because it makes them around less long.
And in general, like making hyperdrivers not very efficient.
No,
making hyperdrive with two encounters for two resources and an action point, that's a minus one because you're spending an action point, two resources to make two resources. So suddenly you can spend two resources and no action point to make one resource, but if you're doing something below rate because you really need these hyperdrivers in play, suddenly now you're going below rate because you really need these hyperdrivers in play, but then you're not doing the thing that lets them stay around longer.
Yeah. Nah.
It's weird.
Weird hero. And not talking about Max either. So more specifically about Count Your Blessings, though, was that the hate piece that kind of popped up a lot was Poison the Well was, I think, the most common piece of hate that we saw in the metagame, which I thought was interesting because of the timing requirements on it, which is basically the hate card doesn't do anything unless it lines up in an instance in which your opponent is casting Count Your Blessings. And something like Gravekeeping, at least like if your opponent has already cast at least one Count Your Blessings, you are getting a lot of value by casting it. And, you know, you can have up to a 1 for 5, which in and of itself is an embarrassing rate. And the adoption of Great Keeping was basically null. I think it was either Talisman of Cremation, if your deck can support it, or Poison the Well, right?
Yeah. I don't think I saw any Grave Keepings at Worlds.
Yeah. So that got me thinking in terms of like timing in Flesh and Blood is really hard because of the nature of drawing new hands basically every turn. So it's hard to make sure that if your opponent is doing something at a given time interval, unless you have it in your arsenal already, there's no way to basically have it guaranteed that what the card you need will line up in the particular circumstance that it will happen. So if we look at a game like Magic the Gathering, I think was the example I talked to you about, where if you have like a counterspell or negate or a card that requires a particular game action to be taken, to be played, it's a lot easier for those types of cards to be good in a game where you're holding on to the same resource over multiple turn cycles. But when you're not holding on to that resource over multiple turn cycles, it's really hard for those one-off interaction effects to line up consistently, unless it's like a commonly reoccurring game plan pattern that like happens over multiple instances in the game.
Yeah, I think that's I guess there's a lot of examples of cards that kind of fill this role of like, you want it to counter a certain thing, but you don't, you can't hold it forever because you only get one arsenal slot basically.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the arsenal slot's really like the limitation on what you can hold. And there's a big cost to like devoting your arsenal slot to a hate card.
Yeah. And you could even think of something like Sink Below being a hate card where it's, it could be lining up against attack reactions, or Sink Below is like a breakpoint hate card where like normally attacking for four is really awkward because most cards block for three. But then when your opponent's attacking for that breakpoint of four, you have the hate card good to go in your arsenal in order to cover it up and answer that card cleanly. And so that's why most commonly I would say defense reactions are placed in arsenal. And that's why, you know, inversely then why Command and Conquer is usually so good, because it both punishes the most commonly type of card arsenaled. And if we get to what is also going to be kind of my next point here, is that the other types of cards that are put in arsenal frequently are like high synergy cards that do require, you know, a particular hand type or play pattern to be available to you in order to like be effective.
Yeah. I agree with that. So.
Oh yeah. So Nathan Crawford did like a 3-hour video on a premise that on its face, I was like, this guy doesn't know anything about Flesh and Blood. It's
wow.
It's crazy. The premise was aggressive decks are fundamentally disadvantaged in Flesh and Blood. And on the face, that sounds silly because it's like the most busted decks in Flesh and Blood have been, you know, very aggressive leaning decks. I think outside of maybe Winter's Whale or like the ice, some of the ice cards, almost every card that's been banned has been a proactive card, right? And you could even argue that things like Winter's Whale or Amulet of Ice like are proactive in a sense, right? Because you're trying to implement a proactive game plan. Like your opponent doesn't need to be having to be doing a very particular thing in order for it to like line up. Your opponent just has to have like cards in hand, which is like, I think that's just going to happen in the game.
Yeah, I guess it's kind, I guess you could kind of say it's proactive. Like is casting a Winner's Bite being proactive? Activating Coronet Peak being proactive?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think in a sense really, it is, but I guess
I wouldn't really describe these things as proactive. I think they're like, but they're not really reactive either because you're not reacting to your opponent. You're not waiting to see what they do. So I guess,
yeah,
it's like proactive, preemptive disruption, I guess. Sure.
Preemptive is a good word. Yeah. I like preemptive. I can go with that. But as he laid out the points, I actually thought his arguments were sound by the end. And I think the biggest example that he went with was that he was watching the most recent cycle of coverage, and it was Enigma versus Azalea, I believe. And basically he realized that Azalea needs to draw a very specific hand texture in order to win the game, where Enigma just needs to draw any four cards in their deck, basically. Like it does, like Enigma's hands that they draw really are completely inconsequential because they're just trying to use their cards defensively and set up like whatever game plan they need to do. But Azalea very specifically needs to draw like the resource card to activate Death Dealer, arrows, and the not attack actions. And if they don't draw like that particular like ratio or that type of hand, then their proactive game plan kind of falls apart. And we've seen that a lot with like Rune Blades, for example, or if they don't draw the attack action and not attack action, you know, or even decks like I was thinking like some instances of Fi, where like or Dorinthia, I guess, where like you really always want to be drawing like one blue and then three red cards in order to like make sure you're paying for your whole turn cycle, right?
Yeah.
But when you're playing a defensive deck that's blocking a lot, you don't really care what color of cards you're drawing all that much, right? You just need cards that say like three or four on the bottom.
Yeah, I think that I do agree with that, but there are obviously a lot of ways that the game favors being proactive or aggressive as well.
Do you want to go into that at all?
Sure. I think the easiest one is that defense, you get 3 per card. Offense, you get 3 per card that has go again and 4 per card that doesn't usually. So if you look at like Wounding Blow, it's a 0 for 4, cost your action point. So in general on offense, you're supposed to get 13 per cycle on offense as long as you do something with your action point, because each card's worth 3 and then your action point's worth 1. So that's very easy, I guess. I shouldn't say very easy, but that's like kind of like the expected amount of value you're getting per hand on offense. Whereas on defense, if you just block with 4 cards, if they're all worth 3, you're getting 12. Obviously, Sink Blow and Fate Foreseen kind of break that dynamic a little bit. And even cards like Oasis, Respite, and
Unmovable to an extent.
Yeah, Unmovable, Staunch Response can all go around that, getting a little bit more than the 3 points per card on defense.
But Count Your Blessings goes above that, right? It's like a defensive card that goes above that rate if you play all the copies, right?
Actually, Count Your Blessings only goes above rate if you're not wasting a resource when you're casting them. So if you're 2 card Count Your Blessings, even if you cast all 9 Count Your Blessings, if you spend 18 cards to cast them, the total you gain is 54 life. That's still 3 points per card. 54 divided by 18 is 3. Mm-hmm. So Count Your Blessings does go above that if you're only spending 5/3 of a card or 5/3 card per Count Your Blessings, because then you're spending 15 total cards. Mm-hmm. And 54 divided by 15 is more than 3.
Do you want to do that math? Do I need to break out a calculator?
It's like 3.6 repeating, I think.
It is. It's 3.6 exactly. Look at you. You're a good math guy. You're good at this math stuff.
It's just 3.6?
It's just 3.6. So yes, 3.6.
Okay. I was close.
Repeating. I guess infinite zeros after the 6.
Yeah, repeating zeros. Yes, that's what I said. 3.6 zero 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 zero.
Repeating, of course.
Yes, the zeros repeat.
I thought that was a point that really wasn't addressed, right? Where, or at least I don't remember being addressed, where offensively there's ways to go much like above the rate of each individual card, where like if you look at something like Lumina Ascension or things like Revel in Runeblood and Viscerai, or like any of these particular cards that like once you have satisfied X condition, you will get a rate above which you will normally get usually on offense, right? There's not really any cards that like if you meet X condition go above rate defensively, right? Maybe That All You Got?
Sure, That All You Got. Den's Blue Mist can go above rate if you're preventing more than 3 attacks with it, or more than 4 attacks.
You're still using a card. Well, I guess like it depends like if you're doing other things with the resources, once again, or using Tunic or whatever.
Yeah, right? Yeah. This is like one that's either 2 cards or 4/3 of a card, depending on how you look at it. So it's somewhere in between those two value or those two costs. But
yeah. So I think what's really interesting about it is that with Count Your Blessings, not even breaking the mold defensively, if we're trying to look at, you know, what James White viewed as what he considers to be a control deck in traditional terms, he's saying a deck that runs your opponent out of threats or effectively invalidates your opponent's strategy, and then winning the game becomes a formality, I believe was the oft quoted line that he put in that article. And we have seen cards that like do try to interact with your opponent on different different individual turn cycles, and a lot of them are like blue block threes, right? Which like a lot of people don't like, with like Warmonger's Diplomacy and Ripple Away are the two biggest examples in my mind.
Yeah, a lot of people being me at least.
That's fair. I mean, it's not, you're not alone in that opinion. I've heard, you know, from just general complaints in the community that there are people out there that actually just don't like the fact that the blue block threes are like an effective way that they're putting in like these hate cards in Flesh and Blood. And I think people have even been comparing them to like, I didn't play Yu-Gi-Oh, but they were called like hand traps or whatever. Do you know what those are?
Yeah, I'm familiar with hand traps.
Yeah, I wasn't really familiar with that concept, but I think hand traps are a lot worse in Flesh and Blood overall because of the nature of like the transient nature of hands, where like in Yu-Gi-Oh, I get like the hand traps being kind of like broken or annoying. But once again, if you draw a hand trap, it's just, you just have the hand trap for every turn cycle afterwards until you actually use it, right?
Yes, though most Yu-Gi-Oh games are basically decided in the first 1 to 2 turn cycles. So your hand traps, like, you kind of just...
Did you have it for the whole game?
Yeah. But I do think Poison the Well is kind of like a very hand trappy card. It doesn't cost anything. You just, when your opponent gains life, you're like, boom, Poison the Well.
Yeah. Or like your opponent tries to like make like place Germinate and you have boom, Ripple Away. Those kinds of things. And and I think the other kind of hand trappy effects that they're printing a lot more are like discard this, prevent damage, get X. I think like with the block cards in the recent set, there's the Runeblade one that gets a rune chance, and
mental
then
mental note, and I don't know the Runeblade one is
called something rebel, some Runebladey, Revely, Arcane-y something.
Yeah, card. I had one in my Pro Tour draft and Haunting Rendition. That's
what it's there. We go. All right, so. I guess coming back to like the hand trap thing and just the transient nature of hands, do you think they could push, like, how far in that direction do you think they can push the cards? Like, at what point do you think it becomes too much of a gotcha mechanic as opposed to something that's like specifically answering something?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because in my opinion, the first version of this wasn't Warmonger's Diplomacy. Our first hand traps were Icelander casting like Chinalik, Frigid, and Hypothermia on your turn from Arsenal.
I guess Snag? Snag was,
yeah,
like
Snag the first was even, yeah, Snag was before my time. So
it was like right as we entered,
maybe,
right?
Blizzard.
With Tyler Horsepool playing Snag against Chain. I remember that's how he won the calling, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, that's the first one that sticks out of my mind, I guess, is like, but once again, that doesn't block three, and neither did Blizzard.
Yeah, though Blizzard was very good for other reasons.
Yeah.
Saying ice and being a blue was just a powerful combination back in the day.
And if we're defining cards in like their use case for the condition being met, your opponent having cards with go again is a pretty common condition that's being met on any given one of their turn cycles.
Though, if your opponent, like, in a lot of worlds, Blizzard, you're spending a card and they're spending 2/3 of a card to counter your card, basically. Like,
Or they just don't care about the fact, and then, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But kind of face up on the card is, hey, for 2/3 of a card, you just counter this. So I think Blizzard has... Well, I do think Blizzard is a very powerful card. It's kind of like very clear how you counter. You just have two resources.
Yeah. I guess, is that a way, do you think they could kind of push more interaction then? Is like, if your opponent does X, counter Y?
I'm not exactly sure, because I think Blizzard had really good play patterns in Guardian, where a lot of the time you drew it, you were like, they're probably going to have extra resources anyway. I don't think there's a lot of reason to play this. Icelander, it was a little bit different because it came with a Frostbite. So suddenly you're trading a blue and they need three resources to really get their go again.
Yeah, and then you're trading a card for a card at that point.
Yeah, so the ceiling was a lot higher on it in Icelander, assuming your opponent was trying to go again.
Yeah. But then we also have effects like energy potion or deja vu potion, or I guess inverted healing potion, like these effects that stick around on the field to be activated at any point in time, those kind of break the transient nature of Flesh and Blood, as well as, well, just the entire illusionist class, just having these maintainable allies, wards, or auras, I guess, in the three that we have so far, but who knows what's next.
Yeah.
But those effects continually to be like the most powerful cards in the game. And I guess they're also additionally, like Count Your Blessings, the most controversial aspects of the game, where there's a lot of people who just hate the illusionist class fundamentally because they are so difficult to interact with, or they are just breaking, I guess, what people call like the core fundamentals of like the hand structure of games.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I think that, weirdly, I feel like the illusionists have gotten more and more closer to playing the game the way it's intended as we've moved on. So, like, I think Prism with her Spectra auras was, like, the most egregious. And then Dromai is, like, closer. It has, like, this value that stays on the board, but you could just attack it, and then it goes away when you attack it. And when you attack it, it doesn't just, like, scam you out of the rest of your turn by fizzling your attack with Spectra. And then now we have Enigma, who ward is just like pre-blocking, basically, right?
Yeah. Something that I kind of realized, like when I was thinking about this episode too, was if you attack me with Wounded Blow, it's just you present 4 damage to me. And if I block for 4 with 2 cards out of my hand, I gain 4 life. I cast a Sink Below. I have ward 4, or I block with armor. Those are all basically the same ways in which to invalidate the card. But it seems like the player base with Count Your Blessings really hates it if you have preemptively gained the life to mitigate their damage.
Yeah, I think that a big part of it is traditionally fatigue decks have really struggled to like make use of their hand if you like take a full hard setup turn where you don't present damage and take cards from them. And now, like, the ways that you fight against Count Your Blessings fatiguing you is different than the ways that we fought against, like, hard fatigue Oldheim in the past, like Charles Dunn style of Oldheim, where you can't just take setup turns without, like setup turns aren't always profitable to take. If your opponent takes that space and casts a Count Your Blessings, or even 2 Count Your Blessings, then that space that you gave them, if you just pushed 10 damage that turn, they probably would have leaked some of the damage versus gaining more life than your setup turn is going to give value to your next hand.
Yeah. And so Enigma, I guess, also like, or Count Your Blessings, Enigma being like that style of fatigue, was also able to gain the life, but also develop the wards. Like play multiple ward cards and get value out of those, which once again is like ward is like gaining life as well. It just has the extra hoop that sometimes can happen where if you have an effect that says damage can't be prevented, it will like negate that card, like that effect, right?
Yeah, it also sometimes your breakpoints can make ward really awkward. So like if I think the easiest example is 10,000 year reunion, ward 10. That's not the same as having 10 extra life. It's probably true. Not eating 10 damage when you put that up.
Yeah, but to that degree, like that's true of like all defense reactions, right? Or just all cards that have that higher defense value. Like if your opponent attacks you for 5 and you use an immovable because you want to stop the on hit or something like that, like you're not getting the full defensive value out of like those big defense reactions.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. It is. It's like preemptively defense reacting, I guess.
Yeah. And I think there's 2 thoughts that I had in ways that like, there's other avenues if like straight life gain is just this hated by the player base to kind of like help fatigue decks, or I'm calling this gaining life without gaining life, where if there was a card that basically put +1 counters on your defense, so basically like you're building up armor, so you could say like, oh, like when this armor, you could just like put block value on it. I guess then
that, a hero that does that, you know?
Yeah. The issue with that be is like, if there was like cards with just like base value defense that don't say like Blade Break or Temper or things like that, that counter is just permanent then, right?
Yeah.
Like the removal of or adding minus one counters would have to be baked into like their hero ability at that point.
I actually think it would just be like put up plus one counter on target equipment that has Blade Break, Temper, or Battle Worn or something. Would be just perfectly fine
template. Yeah, that's actually clean. Yeah, I like that a lot. But because the thing that people said for a long time is, you know, like Guardians start with like 12 extra life because of their fridge, where like you're not actually starting the game at 40, you're starting the game at like 52. And a big level up moment, I think, for like a lot of players is basically like using that armor to be worth more than just the life, right? Where like, I was guilty of this for a long time. And I still think about this, like I still have this instinct in me to like, oh, I'm getting a little low on life. I should use my armor to like preserve my life. But like, that doesn't like fundamentally map out onto the game because it's the same thing, assuming that like you'll be able to block multiple times with it if it has temper or something like that. But the armor, like the actual life total number itself feels more vulnerable being lower than it does like having armor, having some counters on it. It's this very weird feeling, I guess. And I see it happen a lot where people are like, oh, I'm getting a little low. Like I should like block with my armor now. But like, it's not about your life total. It's like, how is that armor? Like what are the cards in your hand worth on that given turn cycle? And do you think you could get more value out of a future hand where you're able to keep more cards because of your armor?
Yeah. I think one thing I've seen a lot is people will be like, yeah, my opponent is doing 20 damage this turn. I should use my armor because it's their big turn.
But
like,
right. Yeah.
That's not really related. You just want to use your armor when it's like stopping something more than just damage. So it doesn't matter if your opponent attacks you for 33 damage. It doesn't mean you should use your armor unless you're going to die if you don't, like literally die that turn if you don't use it.
Exactly. And so I guess like modulating armor could be like an interesting mechanic for like gaining life then without gaining life. As well as like there's, what's the token that like prevents the next time you take an arcane damage? It's not spell void.
It's like an Aegis
from Spellbane Aegis.
Yeah. The things that Jubeal creates, right?
Yeah. A couple effects that create them. Like, Oldheim's specialization that freezes an equipment creates one of those for some reason. But there's not one that just prevents physical damage. And I think that'd be interesting because we've seen effects like that. Like Peace of Mind is a card that's like an instant that's damage prevention that only prevents the next time you would take, you know, physical damage. And if Ward is too cumbersome to basically like, it or it becomes too pushed of a mechanic, I think splitting the ward then between Spellbane Aegis and like a hypothetical second type of token that only prevents physical damage could be an interesting way to go about it as well.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I actually think we will probably get that at some point. It's probably just the mechanic of like a cleric or something that we haven't seen yet.
Yeah. But at the end of the day, like I said, all this is just about players' feelings in their game experience, right? Like the numbers are the same in all of these circumstances at the end of the day. Like it's basically saying like, I don't like it when you go 2 + 2 = 4. I want you to go 1 + 1 + 1 + 1 to make 4. It's like, that makes me feel better. But it's like, at the end of the day, you're still just getting 4, you know?
Yeah. And I remember when Counter Blessings was spoiled, we both kind of thought it was not going to be very good because you have to jump through a lot of hoops to do your 2 + 2 = 4. If you don't get through all these hoops, you end up doing 1 + 1 = 2 and you only get 2. You don't get up to your 4.
Yeah. But even then people are like, I don't like that you got 1 + 1 = 2. I want you to just go 2. And it's like, okay. I don't know. It's just like, this is a very like nebulous concept that I'm trying to like work through, I guess, at the same time. Like I have notes here that I wrote out that I was like trying to work through today, but it's just like, it feels like there should be like some grand unifying like concept that maps onto the game design of Flesh and Blood is like ultimately what I was trying to get up, get to. Do you think there's something like that that exists, or is it just like, because games are hard and we're just dealing with feelings, there's no like actual way to like map this out?
What do you mean, map this out?
Like, come to like a truism, or just like an underlying like design or like game principle in Flesh and Blood that like makes people more okay with the concept of like gaining life, I guess.
Yeah, it's weird because we didn't really have large amounts of life gain. Like, we had Sigil of Solace, then we had like the next life gain cards were like Healing Balm or Sun Kiss, like which were just sigils that costed your action point and block two.
Yeah, so much worse.
I think it's more that just like people aren't used to healing being a big part of the game, and when there's finally some viable healing cards other than Sigil of Solace, it just like feels bad, I guess. But I don't think Count Your Blessings better than Sigil of Solace. It's just like the first time we've had a way to play 9 copies of life gain without getting to cards significantly worse than Sigil of Solace.
Yeah. And I guess I feel like you wanted to keep life gain primarily on instants. Another way you could balance it is to like create more relevant on hits that like punish your opponent for like not blocking them out effectively, right? Where it's like, if there were just more relevant ways that decks were like presenting damage with like, once this hits, do X, it significantly mitigates just like life gain as well, right?
Yeah, I do think that that's kind of what Aurora is really built around doing with Burn Up Shock and Channel Lightning Valley and Snatch. She does have quite a few on hits. The Photon, not Photon Rush, the one that does one arcane if you played a lightning card when it hits also. Mm-hmm.
Static Shock,
yeah. She has quite a few on hits. And I know that Count Your Blessing Enigma just won Worlds, and I think that's a big... I think that Aurora has like probably the tools to beat Count Your Blessings if they were prepared for it, I guess. I don't think anyone was like overly testing again, or not any, I shouldn't say I don't think anyone was, but Count Your Blessings Enigma was not one of the big decks that everyone was preparing for going into this weekend.
Yeah, people knew that they'd be around, but people didn't think like they'd be like a top level viable strategy, I think. And I think like that's why a lot of people were like really surprised when they were heard like Michael Hamilton's on Count Your Blessings. Like, what's happening here? Like, this isn't supposed to be like a top level professional level event like strategy. This is supposed to be like something that's like dominating armories, I feel like, was kind of like the perception around the card.
Yeah, and it definitely like I think it kind of showed where like there were, I think, one deck playing Poison the Well, or maybe two decks playing Poison the Well in the top 8 of the event. And at least one of those decks, it's my opinion that Poison the Well is not the right hate card for it.
Yeah, Gravekeeping.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
I remember I was talking to somebody about the event, or before the event. I was like, I'm a little nervous about playing a Count Your Blessings deck. Like, what if everybody's like playing like a bunch of like hate cards? And they were like, nah, people don't play hate cards. And I was like, I guess they were right. People really just don't like bringing the hate cards. I think the most ubiquitous hate cards that people were bringing for the longest time, but even then it's like, whatever. It was like poppers, right? For Prism, where it's like, everybody was like, got to put in your poppers for Prism to make sure you can pop their Phantasm cards.
Yeah, and a lot of the time, there wasn't good testing that led to like which poppers you play or the amount of poppers you play. It's just like, oh, Prism, I need to slam poppers into my deck. But a lot of the time, that just like was lowering your win rate into Prism by having them there, since she at least old Prism, I still remember these conversations around old Prism, was a lot of the time her game plans did not involve attacking with heralds that often against many heroes.
Yeah, and what was kind of sick, I remember this was like a level up moment that I had probably way too late in my lifespan of like playing original Prism, was that you could like potentially try to like use a herald to like actually bait the high damage cards out of your opponent's hand, where like my initial reaction, I guess, also playing against Prism was like, oh, they're playing a Phantasm thing, pop it. But like, you should actually do the math to see like if you are dealing more damage or that card's actually critical to like having a turn that deals more than like 4 damage without your like 6 power plus card. Because if you use your only like high damage card in order to like pop this Phantasm, and then they deploy a ward, and but like Prism's like very comfortable playing like that hyper long grindy game with her auras as well.
Yeah, and like Prism could also like run decks out of threats too. It had a weird weapons, but it did have a pretty good weapon that let you attack a lot of times for free.
Yeah.
So if you were not presenting enough damage, sometimes you would just run out of threats and die. So if your hand was like if a Prism's attacking you with a blue Wartoon Herald and your hand's like Command and Conquer and 3 blues, and you pop with Command and Conquer, your 3 blues are worth 4, maybe you should just, you know, blocked with one of the blues and set the Command and Conquer.
And it's good that you brought up Prism, because like you were just talking about with weapons, the whole start and play, stay and play, the sips, as I think they're called, where just getting these raw amount of action points or just general resources with cards that, you know, are able to break the fundamentals of the game by staying in play turn over turn, always being available, always having a constant effect that is just warping the dynamic of like what cards' values are worth, also have been some of the most impactful things we've seen, right?
Yeah, I think some of the best equipment in the game, like you look at Grasp of the Arknight, you look at Crown of Seeds, you look at, I don't know, there's like these reoccurring pieces of equipment that you just use over and over again. You look at just good weapons like Rosetta Thorn, Searing Emberblade, Waning Moon, and these cards just like significantly alter your play patterns and let you do really powerful things repeatedly. But even one-time use effects, like, or limited use effects, like if you look at Snapdragon Scalers, a lot of the time having access to Snapdragon Scalers just like changes how you can fundamentally build and play your deck. Like you play Snatch with 4 cards in hand and no go again, and your opponent looks at your Snapdragon Scalers and they're like, man, I have to block this out, because if it hits, you're going to draw a card and then you're going to have a whole turn.
Yeah, Mask of the Pouncing Lynx as well is like a card that makes every card, you like, you never, like the sense of anticipation with that card is like really interesting, because it's like, what is my opponent going to do the thing? Like, do I have to block this one? Are they going to break it now? Are they going to break it now? Are they going to break it if this Phoenix Flame hits? And it's just like, and I remember like when my opponent would like break their Mask of the Pouncing Lynx, I'm like, thank God I don't have to think about this anymore. I could just like play the game straight up from now. Like, phew, we're done with this part of the game. This feels a lot better now.
Yeah. And one that's probably even like a similar power level, probably a little bit better than Mask of the Pouncing Lynx even, is Traverse the Universe, where there's been turns where you're just like, man, it's better for me just not to attack you, because I don't think I can win the game if you get an extra chi this hand, because I'm not sending any disruption, I'm not doing anything. So if you just go to 6 card hand and kill me, I can't. So you just like don't attack.
Yeah, been there. But then I think the ones that we didn't touch on that we were also touching on with Luminaris, which was just cards that give action points. And that's why I hated Voltaire. I hated Voltaire so much. Just getting those action points to enable those arrows every turn just felt so oppressive. And I still feel so vindicated when James was like, yeah, Voltaire's broken. It's too good. I don't like it. I was like, yes, thank you. I too hate that card.
Yeah, it's funny because like, from a numbers perspective, Voltaire is like way worse than Death Dealer. Death Dealer, you spend a third of a card to draw a card, and that's just a really good deal. Compared to Voltaire, you spend a third of a card for go again, or a third of a card for 1 extra damage, which is fine. That's like just like on rate, you know, but you got to do it twice per turn with Voltaire, and the arrows have the drawback of you can only play them from Arsenal. So they have to be better than regular attacks, basically, for that to make sense to have that drawback. So you suddenly get to play these reasonably better than average cards, and you have this weapon that lets you cheat on action points. And then you have Codex, which also lets you cheat the arrow cost of, or the arrow, getting an arrow into Arsenal.
Yeah, and it also touches on the power of having equipment or effects that could be activated at instant speed. Because that was the other thing that was really game-breaking about Voltaire in particular, where if you were on the draw, you just got to like activate Voltaire once or twice, potentially, depending on like what your arrows were, and just like, oh, look at that. I was actually on the play too. Like I get to start the game with a 4 or 5 card hand as well, but I was on the draw. Like, that was silly.
Yeah, that's always been like a really weird dynamic of instance. Just like going second, you get value on your opponent's first turn. Like, I think the first time that really stood out to me was in Outsiders Limited, because I would always draft the Peace of Minds and I'd be going second a lot, because every time I won the die roll, I was going second. And a lot of the time I'd have a Peace of Mind and I just play a Peace of Mind on my opponent's turn, and I'd go into my first turn with 4 cards and a Ponder token, which is worse than having 5 cards, but not significantly. It's pretty close to having a 5 card hand.
Yeah. Yeah, whoever thought Peace of Mind was not good in that format must have been a really silly person, that's for sure. And shout out to Nathan. And there was and we look at Storm Striders as a way that cheats on like instant speed interactions in order to like close out games. Cause that was the whole fundamental premise behind Icelander as well, was basically like you get to have these not only above rate attacks, but like as you're just damage racing your opponent, you get to cheat the end game in which you take 2 turns in a row effectively.
Yeah, I don't think it's anywhere near as good as 2 turns in a row, but there's like, you start down 4 health, and Storm Strider is usually made up for more than that, because you would go Storm Striders into some damaging spell, plus you had Waning Moon, which was turned on by the fact that you used Storm Striders. So yeah, it's on its face, it's just one action point, but the fact that the way the game works is you play your offensive turn, then you draw up, and then you have your defensive turn. And if you are able to use those cards on offense during your defensive turn, you can do it before your opponent gets to draw up with a chance to, or so they don't have a chance to block with their next hand. It just like breaks the ebb and flow of the game.
Yeah. So I think those are all like the major topics I wanted to touch on. Like I said, this all just kind of started off with me just musing about the intricacies of Count Your Blessings. And I feel like we kind of addressed those pretty thoroughly at this point. Do you have any like final thoughts as like we wrap things up here?
Yeah, I think that ultimately, because of how timing works for things like Poison the Ball, which is how we got here in the first place, or got to the subject in the first place, it's really important that, like, I think it's true for any hate card, that you test with the card and make sure that like the situations where it's good are happening frequently enough that it's worth putting a card in your deck that just like doesn't gel with the rest of your deck's game plan.
Yeah, 100%. I remember for a while I was testing Ripple Away in new in particular, and I was like, well, you know, I have this blue block 3 card. Like, what's like, it's fine, right? Like, I just get to play it, no big deal. But then there were just instances where it's like, oh man, I have Ripple Away, my opponent has many tokens, and I just have this awful blue 2-for-4 attack in my hand, where it's just like, oh, I guess the best thing I can do is attack with this Ripple Away this turn. Like, that feels real bad for a card that's just like a blue block 3 that's free to put in your deck, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting because news blues are like so, I don't want to say taxed, but like you want very specific things out of them. You want disruption, and you want just the neck targets, and every blue that you put in that doesn't do either of those things is a pretty big cost. And I guess Ripple Away kind of does disruption, but it's like,
yeah,
not on turns where your opponent's wants to make enough value of tokens that is correct to discard Ripple Away.
Yeah. Maybe Dorinthia needs Ripple Away then. Just replace whatever mopey horrible blue she's got anyways, just throw in some Ripple Aways, easy, boom.
Okay, Dorinthia's blue base, like, it's not good, but I think how bad it is overstated. Like, have you seen Ira's blue base?
Oh, yeah. It's like
you want to see bad blues.
Yeah. I feel pretty vindicated for saying that hero's not, like, very, very good. I know it top eighted the calling in Osaka, but, like, it just, that hero just feels like, if you looked up fair flesh and blood in the dictionary, I think Ira's picture would, like, pop up.
Yeah. I do think Ira's kind of like queen of fair flesh and blood, but man, her blues leave a lot to be desired.
Yeah, that's for sure.
It's like Katsu's blues, but you also don't really get Ancestral Harmony. You're not really an Ancestral Harmony deck. So
yeah,
back to Katsu pre-Ancestral Harmony.
True. And they all have to be the zero cost in order to make use of your Kadashis. So there's that restriction on them too.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think that's all I have to say. But I hope people took something away from this. Maybe help them look at some aspect of the game differently. Just trying to make sure that people have, like, I think it's really easy to get into the same thought patterns day in and day out about, like, aspects of the game, or think the game ought to perform a certain thing or play a certain way or view particular cards through a very, like, narrow lens. And I really try to, like, challenge myself and the people around me to make sure that they have, like, a broader perspective on not just flesh and blood cards, but all things in life. So hopefully if one person got any of that out of this, I think this was a worthwhile episode.
Awesome. I agree. I think it's very easy to fall into habits and patterns and not recognize the conscious decisions you're making in games and life in general, I guess.
Yeah. Thankfully, I have a very diverse life that doesn't really follow the same patterns very often. But the next time you're not falling into patterns very often, always remember, mind your manners. Thanks for watching.